Hello, I'm Maxi B, and this is Minisode 12 of Friendship, Effort, Victory, all about Ryu Fujisaki's Wok Wok. We're at the end of this first foray into Ryu Fujisaki's career in Weekly Shonen Jump, and suitably enough, we do come to the last series he created for the anthology, Wok Wok. Not just that, but it is easily the work most attuned to Ryu Fujisaki's strengths as a high-concept science fiction writer with a sweet tooth for weird gags. If you combine that with the artistic evolution Fujisaki had gone through in all his previous works leading up to Wak Wak, it stands tall as the prettiest of his Weekly Shonen Jump series. It had all this going for it, and yet today's spotlight isn't a success by any strength of the word, having only lasted 4 volumes, with around 30-some chapters to its name. So we must wonder why and how Wak Wak could have failed, and if my initial assessment of it as having all these strengths is strictly true, or just a bias of someone too deeply entrenched in Fujisaki's career path. One clear factor could simply be the competition it had when it came out. 2004 was a pretty strong year for Weekly Shonen Jump, with the debuts of hits like Gintama, Death Note, Reborn, D Greyman, and even a new series from the legendary creator Hirohiko Araki, Steel Ball Run. That's 6 budding new series piling into a magazine that was still running huge titles like One Piece, Bleach, Naruto, Eyeshield 21, and Pewterfuku Jaguar as well. The majority of the magazine was taken up with all these smashes, new and old, and so it'd be easy enough for something like Wak Wak to fall by the wayside, even with a big-name creator. Heck, the same things happened that year to other popular 90s creators, with Hellteacher Noob's Takeshi Akano and Hallelujah 2's Haruto Umezawa floundering with their attempts at new series. But to lay it purely at the feet of the flood of popular titles drowning out smaller stuff would be to dismiss any actual analysis of Wak Wak and the failings it may have had in the eyes of the young Weekly Shonen Jump readers of the time. So let's talk about what Wak Wak even was, shall we? Wak Wak is, in essence, about this teenage girl Matsuda who isn't actually God being taken into a future where she basically is. But that's complicated and can only really be expanded upon by talking about the various players on the board and the future that she finds herself in. The world of Wak Wak itself is a desolate wasteland, overrun by strange machine creatures that attack what few settlements are left around the world. These settlements are lived in by the black-blooded humans, a race of human-machine hybrids that are basically human in all respects save their blood and unusual diet of oily items. Other than these settlements, there is also the Spider's Thread, a huge tower going into the sky that no one dares go near, an ancient machine designed to draw in human blood so as to grant a single wish. Traditional red-blooded humans were wiped out many years ago by a disease, already having had their numbers dwindle in the conflict between them and the Blackbloods. In fact, naught but one red blood remained, the mysterious villain of the piece, squirreled away in the Spider's Thread whilst using a bloody avatar to go about his schemes, including the transporting of Matsuda into the future as part of a rather complicated plan to make the Guardians fight each other. The Guardians are 7 special black-blooded humans who confused with Gojin Zo to fight off the machines and protect the remaining villagers. Each Guardian's Gojin Zo has a different ability and a different appearance when activated as armor, and if one Guardian defeats another, then their Gojin Zo will snack upon the losers and gain their abilities, storing their memories and the wishes of their former host within, information that the Guardians must accept if they want to fully utilize these new abilities. The Guardians come in a great variety of sizes and personalities, as they should do when you consider that they're actually the key character type within the series, and they all have their own wish they'd have granted by spinning the blood of the red-blooded god on the special altar up in Spider's Thread. So Matsuda's appearance as a red-blooded human all of a sudden spurs many of them to action, intending to use her to have their way with the world, if only they deal with all the other Guardians first so that their wish is the one to be granted, or at least that's the way it's explained by our evil human sage up in the Spider's Thread. In reality, it's all just a game between him and the black-blooded sage to see who can wish for the other's destruction. And even then, he might not so much be intending to play a fair game. This all sounds quite complicated, but Ryu Fujisaki makes sure to set it all up clearly and carefully, doing some fantastic initial world-building in the first few chapters and expanding upon it as the series goes on. If there were any downside to how he goes about getting all this going, it's that he gives us this conflict between the Guardians, and then puts the pedal to the metal, rushing through everything right up to the final conflict without really stopping to give you time to breathe. This is pretty much a given when your series only lasts 4 volumes, but But this doesn't even wait till the usual points you've become aware that a series isn't doing too hot. It's rushing through fights from as early as the third or fourth chapter, all in the name of making sure that the actual story gets to happen. Understandable when Fujisaki's last series, Sakura Tetsu Taiwahen, died at the 2-volume mark, but goodness, it gets a bit of a headache at times. It's some relief then that the opening setup and establishing of the young guardian Shio as the protagonist of the series is handled at a comparatively sedate pace. Yes, rather than have Masuda as the main character, Fujisaki instead opts to go as Shio, the son of a guardian who believes in pacifism and giving proper graves and funerals to the machines that they must kill to protect the Black Bloods. He's a diddly little guy with a mohawk and a baggy hooded outfit, and despite a couple of fiddly bits, his design is incredibly solid as Shonen Jump protagonists go, but I'll come back to that. We get to see some of him as this powerless kid, travelling with his father as he fights off the machines and visits villages, but then this all gets upturned as a giant girl-shaped amalgamation of machines attacks a village they're at, and Shio's father becomes gravely wounded, removing the heart powering it. The heart also happens to be the unconscious Masuda. Shio's dad sees the truth of her being a red-blooded god and charges Shio with taking his Gojinzo Armoriti and using it to protect her. This is kind of mixed as these things go. On the one hand, a young kid loses his dad brutally and his powers are fresh and unrefined, but he does come out the gate with the god already in his hands, even if his peaceful ways means that he's actually hesitant to fight others or sacrifice her for the wish. But fight he must, and once Masuda is taken away to the spider's thread, Shio's quest begins proper to travel across the wasteland and defeat the other guardians to retrieve Masuda and wish for everyone to be happy. A wish that could very well make it, so Masuda may continue to live. Because, I mean, her being happy probably has to be alive. He's joined by those who have been healed and empowered by Masuda's blood from the first leg of their journey, the little mascot robot Plasti and the former guardian Leo, who lost his Gojinzo Asher to Shio early on in the story. Oh, and a weird kid who read an old Fujiko Fujio-esque comic and now thinks he knows ninjutsu. The weird thing being, his comic-inspired techniques actually work. He can do the whole walking on water with wooden discs and gliding away holding a sheet with his hands and feet. In fact, the more I'm thinking about this, the more this kid stands out as one of the most wonderfully out-of-place characters in the series, and as such, is probably my hands-down favourite character in the entire book. And this is saying nothing of his cutesy My First Ninja style design. Though, to praise any one design in Whack Whack over any others would feel wrong, it must be said, as there's so many brilliant characters on display. I mentioned Shio earlier, and loath as I am to obsess over the silhouette test, he passes it with flying colours in at least three guises. His core looks are twofold, one of which is his mohawk short hair combo, using two tones to differentiate the two bits of hair, which looks good and was completely unlike any of the other Shonen Jump protagonists of the time, and the other main look for him is with his hood up, which turns him into a goggled-eyed cartoonish blob shape, all loose clothing and big limbs, with a tuft of hair or fur or something coming out the top of his hood. This allows Fujisaki to not only have an iconic look for Shio, but to pull the same trick he used for Taiko Bo in Hoshinengi, where he can do a hastily scrawled goofy stickman version for quick gags or emotionally suitable moments. Actually, stickman isn't the right word for this, the look being more of a pear shape, but the point is that it's a well-designed iconic look that's immediately recognisable as a silhouette, making him pretty ideal as a Shonen Jump hero. The rival character Leo has some interesting stuff going on as well, being a handsome, spiky-haired, grump-looking guy to appeal to the rival-loving female audience, and consists of long, slender components, from his hair to his lanky limbs and his flame katana sword thing. It's often overlooked as to how important it is to have your side characters so well-themed like this, and I think it pays off. There's also this thing where in his first antagonistic role, he looks completely different with these huge haunted panda eyes where his constant trauma-induced migraines have kept him from sleeping for the longest time. It was quite a clever touch as it made him look more like a throwaway villain or at best a peculiar sub-boss type enemy. But as soon as he's beaten and healed by Masuda's blood, his eyes change to normal and his visual elements instead pop as that of a sort of semi-macho Bashonen type, all whip thin and pretty, but sour-faced and ready to fight at a moment's notice. I feel the way this worked may have been lost on the audience at the time, but it's interesting to note all the same. The mascot characters, as well, really need to be mentioned. It's quite typical of a manga to try and have something marketable in it, a cutesy item that can sell to all ages, and this is where the small robot Plasti comes in. Being a pretty simple shaped teddy bear sort of shaped robot, I guess it's shaped like that, I said shaped too many times, with enough elements of its own to work as the sort of thing you could sell as a plush doll or the like. If you're reaching for examples of these, think of stuff like Tony Tony Chopper in One Piece, Kon from Bleach, or Tim Campy from D. Gray Man. You know, cutesy little things. See? Plasti's failing is that by being quite a clinical-looking robot shell, he lacks the softness or cute element that those examples have, and as such never really struck a chord with readers. Shio's Gojinzo stood a bit of a better chance, being a softer, more mutable being, but overall the Gojinzo are played as so secondary to the actual Guardians that they don't get enough time to shine as anything other than well-designed alt forms for the armors. And oh boy, the Guardian armors. For the most part, these are highly detailed shells worn by fighters, and can range from Evangelion-esque suits like Kaf and Shio's dad have, to weird water beings, even to weird branched tentacle arrangements. Actually, that's an interesting one, as the Guardian using it is a literal giant in a crown, another early sign of the robotic or just inhuman nature of the Black Bloods, all the way to the smooth, kiddie plastic look of Shio's combo with Armoriti. Oh, and the freakish multi-armed god of the Guardian Yoki, but that one weirds me out a bunch. Armoriti as an armor gets the most use, which goes towards explaining his comparatively simple look, allowing for him to get modular, throwing in elements of other Gojinzo as he cannibalizes them throughout the journey. It doesn't always look too good, with the wood tentacle addition looking quite hideous as design elements on Armoriti go, but it's fit for purpose, and you have to admire the design sense involved in making a modular suit like that work in a comic. All this design stuff combines well with the typical shonen trappings to create something that should be marketable, successful even, but for whatever reason Wok Wok just floundered, not even living a full year before people moved on and it got the axe. A huge part of this could be that Fujisaki's style just isn't suited to Shonen Jump, something backed up by his recent success with the horror series Shiki over at its sister magazine Jump SQ, aimed at a slightly more mature audience. His weird humour and tendency to play with format may have also played a huge part, another thing backed up by Shiki's existence, where he's working alongside the author of the original novel, or rather where he was working alongside the author of the original novel, reducing his creative tics by a sizable amount. There's also that earlier environment I was talking about, where older creators, Takeshi Obata aside, were falling by the wayside against the fresh new talent that was dominating the anthology. Oh, and this is all saying nothing of the troubled life of sci-fi titles in Jump over the last so many years anyway, with them either having to be so entrenched in other genres, like the battle title Siren, or the shuddersome ecchi comedy To Love Ru, or being such an oddity that they die fairly early in, like stars. Whack Whack seems to try for the best of both worlds, being a science fiction oddity, telling a fairly straightforward battle manga story, albeit one entrenched in weirdness and religious reference. The religious reference being the Amisha Spenta, which is so complicated to explain, I'll just leave a link to it in the show notes later. Okay? Okay. And to be honest, it suffers all the more for it, with a bit of a identity crisis that on the surface might leave people cold. I mean, look at how much I've had to look into the craft to like it as much as I do. To a kid, and I mean, kids being the sort of people who perhaps aren't interested in basically writing essays on the virtues of what they're reading, Wak Wak probably didn't work at all. That pacing I brought up earlier is a killer as well. Comics in Japan have little in common with the Western scene. Whilst over here a short run can be okay or critically lauded regardless of actual success, a desirable element even in some cases, to have something feel like it's running towards the end from the get-go can be horrific for readers who usually invest years of time reading a weekly series in Japan. One might even imagine that by the point Shio has died and come back to life due to Masuda's blood as a super-fast, ultra-powerful hero, by the way, spoilers, then seeing him quite literally running towards the end and the final boss fight might well have been a tipping point. A real shame, as the final conflict between Shio and the Last Human is fascinating, full of gorgeous, intelligent, and blisteringly funny moments that really make it feel like the climax to the work of such an auteured manga artist. But alas, end it did, with Wak Wak running a tidy 4 volumes. Such a small run really leaves it running the risk of being forgotten to the annals of time, a true crime considering how well it works as the compression and refinement of Ryu Fujisaki, a creator who we've established over the last few episodes of the show has had an tense career path that has ended at this point in time in Weekly Shonen Jump with this series, and due to how it all works out, it's far too easy to feel this is not going out with a bang, but with a whimper. Our small comfort is knowing that, A, he's still doing work elsewhere in Jump SQ and Miracle Jump, and two, that to those who read this work, we know that it was anything but a whimper. Quack Quack is a great example of an unusual licensing choice by Viz Media, and I can confidently say that it was a great one, with their adaptation being one of their stronger and easiest to get into out of their entire Shonen Jump line of graphic novels. At present, they haven't opted to put it onto their digital store, but the whole four volumes are currently in print and available pretty much anywhere you can find manga, be it online, bookstores, or even comic book stores if your ones are any good. And of course, if you want them in the original Japanese, that's an option as well, with the 3-volume Bunkaban version still very much available from their 2008 re-release. There's nothing all that fancy about them, save some new cover design stuff going on, but they are a tidy package to have all the original material in. Whichever option you go for, you really can't lose. If you want to see show notes and visual aids for this episode, head over to friendshipeffortvictory.wordpress.com, where new episodes are going to continue coming out, at least until the series finale, alternating between the minisodes like this and the full-blown in-depth episodes like the upcoming JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, the never-ending weird horror title by the immortal man Hirohiko Araki. I'll be dealing with the original series, which is in itself 5 series combined into one, so it's going to be a long and brutal one, I'm sure. You can also subscribe either by the RSS feed or on the iTunes page, which is broken, and I actually do know why now, so it should be fixed before the next episode is out. There's also a whole bunch of links to where you can find me on the internet. There's my Twitter, where you can follow me, my email, where you can contact me, and my Tumblr, where you can find bonus material for each episode, information about the upcoming second series, and a bunch of posts relevant to mine and your interests.